Calorama, a Recorded Books High Bridge imprint, presents Leadership from Bad to Worse, What Happens When Bad Festers, by Barbara Kellerman, read by Linda Jones. How did you go bankrupt? Bill asked.
Two ways, Mike said. Gradually, then suddenly.
Ernest Hemingway, The Sun Also Rises. Prologue. The present. Bad leadership and its conjoined twin, bad followership, are as ubiquitous as they are pernicious. They are everywhere in business and government, in religion and education and the military, in democracies as well as autocracies. It's why I've been interested in bad for years. In 2000, I wrote an essay titled Hitler's Ghost, A Manifesto. In 2004, I published a book titled Bad Leadership, What It Is, How It Happens, Why It Matters. And in 2021, I came out with The Enablers, How Team Trump Flunked the Pandemic and Failed America, a book about bad followers. What I never could have imagined is that within months of my conceiving of and then writing the present book, about how unless bad leaders are stopped or at least slowed, they will inevitably, inexorably get worse, would come an earth-shaking event that exemplified my point. It was the first war on European soil since the end of the Second World War. Putin's war, it's been called. Russian President Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine on February 24, 2022. The war is evidence of how a leader who had long behaved badly, who was long unbound either by the rule of law or by the international order, would in time behave more badly. During the entirety of Putin's more than two decades in office, he displayed an insatiable appetite for both great power and great wealth. But his cravings and the criminalities they necessarily entailed remained unchecked. No great surprise, then, that his bad behavior did not, over the years, change for the better. Instead, it changed for the worse. Putin is typical. He did not metamorphose from one kind of leader into another kind of leader overnight. To the contrary, his trajectory from bad to worse was gradual. Early in his tenure as president of Russia, beginning in 1999, Putin made clear that he was prepared to use all-out force to destroy, even to kill, to get what he wanted when he wanted it. On his orders, renegades in Chechnya, a republic of Russia, were wiped out. Chechnya's capital city, Grozny, was bombed, and the Chechen people were compelled to become vassals of the Russian state. Notwithstanding the early evidence of his extreme brutality and rampant corruption, Putin was left alone, free to continue to lead as he saw fit. It explains why, over time, Putin became increasingly greedy and autocratic, and why, over more time, he became more dictatorial. In 2004, he scrapped local elections. In 2006, two of his most prominent critics were mysteriously murdered. In 2007, he delivered a ferocious speech in Munich that signaled his hardened positions vis-à-vis the West, especially the United States. In 2008, he used the Russian military to impose his will on an independent state, Georgia. In 2011 and 2012, he crushed his opposition, ordinary Russians who took to the streets to protest him and his government. And in 2014, he invaded and then annexed Crimea, simply seizing it from Ukraine. It was this event, to which the West did not respond in any serious way, that triggered what became a chronic conflict in eastern Ukraine. In 2015, he intervened militarily in the war in Syria, which included leveling the ancient city of Aleppo. In 2020, his agents tried again, once more unsuccessfully, to murder his single most prominent and politically dangerous opponent, Alexei Navalny. In 2020, Putin arranged for the Russian Duma to eliminate term limits, which meant he could run again for president in 2024 and, potentially, hold office until 2036.
and in 2022, pursuant to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, he instigated what an essay in Foreign Affairs described as a new police state, with methods reminiscent of Joseph Stalin's. About Putin's trajectory from bad to worse, three comments. First, it provides clear evidence that during his decades-long tenure in office, he changed. Former National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice put it this way, "I've seen Putin go from a little shy to pretty shy to arrogant, and now megalomaniacal." Second, it reminds us that until Russia invaded all of Ukraine, the changes in Putin elicited no significant resistance or repercussions either within Russia or without. Third, given that over more than two decades Putin's leadership was permitted to go from bad to worse and then to still worse, it was probable, even predictable, that eventually it would become evil. Evil leadership, as I have defined it, is when the leader and at least some followers commit atrocities. They use pain as an instrument of power. The harm done to men, women, and children is severe rather than slight. The harm can be physical or psychological, or it can be both. Putin's war exemplifies evil leadership. Putin's war is why in March 2023, just over a year after the war began, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for the Russian president for war crimes. But to witness the progression from bad leadership to worse, Americans are not limited to looking abroad. They can look at home. In recent years, liberal democracies, including but not limited to the United States, have been bedeviled by what is widely perceived as bad leadership and followership. Leaders of every stripe on a slide of disrespect and disrepute, and followers of every stripe on a slide of disappointment and disillusion. The presidency of Donald Trump, judged by many, including professional historians, to be one of the worst in American history, is an example. His tenure in the White House was a menace as serious as it was unforeseen. A menace to American democracy that came out of left field, or seemed to, at least in part because neither the American people nor the leadership industry typically pay bad leadership close, careful attention. Which is ironic, given that most Americans are now persuaded that bad leaders are inevitable. Only 46% have a positive view of big business. Fully 65% of Americans believe politicians run for office to serve their own personal interests. And more generally, Americans have an overwhelming lack of trust in key groups of people who are in positions of power, including K-12 public school principals, journalists, military leaders, police officers, leaders of technology companies, and religious leaders. But while most Americans think bad leaders inescapable, we, usually assume that though those leaders are bad, they are not that bad. Most strikingly, until recently, we have taken our political system for granted, presuming that autocratic leadership, fascist leadership, could never and would never happen here in the United States of America. And, until recently, we have taken our economic system for granted, presuming that corporate leaders would restrain themselves, never get to the point of being so rich and powerful that a single individual, think Elon Musk, could ever or would ever be dominant in the marketplace, cyberspace, and outer space. Like Putin's time in the Kremlin, Trump's time in Washington testifies to the point I make in this book. Trump, too, went from bad to worse. To take perhaps the most obvious example, the tens of thousands of outright lies that he told during his 4 years in the White House ultimately culminated in the big lie. The lie that it was not Joe Biden who won the 2020 presidential election, but Donald Trump. The lie that led to the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The lie that, along with the relentless pressure on Vice President Mike Pence not to certify the results of the election, constituted a blatant and malevolent, if ultimately failed, coup attempt. The lie led to widespread worry that Madisonian democracy was genuinely in peril. Though Trump was the first president in American history to be twice impeached, he was twice acquitted by the U.S. Senate. These botched attempts to oust the chief executive laid bare the fundamental weakness of Congress's oversight power, while ensuring that Trump's term in the White House was neither seriously interrupted nor effectively impeded. It's why he and his followers epitomized the trajectory that I describe in this book. Once bad leadership and followership set in, as they did during the first year of Trump's tenure, bad became worse. And then, as he descended into blatant racism and anti-Semitism, and into warnings of death and destruction should things fail in the eyes of the law to go his way, still worse. It was a logical, if not entirely predictable, outcome of this sequence that in time, some 2 years after he left the White House, Trump became the first former president to face criminal charges. By the end of the summer 2023, he had been charged in fully 4 separate criminal cases. He was accused, for example, by the Department of Justice, of willfully retaining national defense secrets in violation of the Espionage Act, making false statements, and a conspiracy to obstruct justice. Inevitably, Trump's bad leadership was in tandem with bad followership. Most importantly, he elicited and enlisted those I label enablers. Enablers are followers who allow or even encourage their leaders to engage in and then to persist in behaviors that are destructive. Like bad leaders, bad followers with enablers at the top of the list change. Over time, they metastasize, they get worse, unless, until, somehow, they are stopped, or at least slowed. The process of going from bad to worse tends to be steady, not sudden or hasty. But once bad has burrowed in, it digs in deep and then deeper, making it finally very difficult to extract or excise. In other words, once the system is close to being completely corrupted, it's late, maybe even too late. By then, bad leaders and their followers are so entrenched that they control the system itself, which is why at this point, the only way to totally get rid of bad is to totally get rid of everyone involved. This book looks at how bad leadership and bad followership evolve. As we will see, sometimes bad is obvious almost from the get-go. Other times, it reveals itself only slowly, surreptitiously, occasionally even imperceptibly. In any case, bad leadership and bad followership go through 4 phases of development as they worm their way deeply and completely into the group or organization of which they are a part. One purpose of this book is, then, to serve as an early warning system. It anticipates that by breaking bad leadership and followership into phases, each worse than the one before, their progression will be easier to predict and detect, and easier, therefore, to stop or at least slow before they turn toxic. The trajectory from bad leadership to worse is not limited to the public sector, of course. It applies equally to the private sector, where leaders such as WeWork's Adam Neumann, Wells Fargo's John Stumpf, Uber's Travis Kalanick, and Purdue Pharma's Sackler family members similarly went from being bad to being worse. Hence, the focus in this book is on leaders in both government and business. This is not to say that other leaders in other areas, say education or religion, are unimportant or less prone to the decay to which I allude. But leaders who are presidents, especially of sizable countries, and CEOs, especially of sizable companies, are usually very powerful and, therefore, very well chronicled. The book zeroes in on 4 leaders who are exemplars, leaders who, though they might have been in some ways good, ultimately were bad, as I define the term, about which more in Chapter 3. I do not single out leaders only in democracies or only in autocracies. While people in the West, especially Americans, tend to think that leaders in autocracies are prone to being bad, while leaders in democracies are prone to being good, it is not nearly so simple. True, Americans associate democracy with freedom and independence, and autocracies with controls and constraints. Better, therefore, we assume, to live and work in a democracy than in an autocracy. But as we will see, that is not necessarily the case, or at least not in every instance or in every way. We cannot count on leaders, or for that matter on followers, anywhere, to be always or even mostly good. It's the nature of the human condition to be good sometimes and not good sometimes. And as we will further see, unless bad leaders and their followers are corrected, their errors will be compounded. They will go from being bad to being worse. Part one of the book sets the stage. It's a general discussion of the phenomenon in question, beginning with a chapter on democracy and capitalism, because these linchpins of good governance have been obviously in decline. Democracies are far more fractious and perceptibly less effective than they used to be, hapless in addressing many of our most pressing problems. Capitalism has been on a similar trajectory, seemingly powerless, certainly in the United States, to remove or even restrain what has become the most obvious thorn in its collective side, inequality in income and in wealth. Leaders and their followers are responsible for these declines, which brings us to Chapter 2, a discussion of leadership and followership in the 21st century. In recent decades, leadership has changed significantly, and followership has changed even more. There is, further, a relationship between democracy and capitalism on the one hand, and leadership and followership on the other. For example, one of the reasons democracies have been decreasing in number while autocracies have been increasing in number is that followers have changed. For reasons ranging from the nature of 21st century parenting to the nature of 21st century media, especially social media, followers are less conforming and more demanding, which is precisely why leaders not committed to democracy try largely or even entirely to control them. And one of the reasons capitalist systems are viewed as less attractive and socialist systems as more attractive, notably among young Americans, is that leaders have changed. Over time, they have become less civic-minded and more self-interested, or at least we perceive them as such. Chapter 3 tries, though I confess at the outset that it succeeds only in part, to make meaning of being bad. I wrestle with questions like these. What does it mean for a leader or a follower to be bad? How can we make sense of being bad if your bad leader or follower might well be my good one? Why even take on bad leadership and followership given the complexities they inevitably evoke and the challenges they invariably present? And what does leadership going from bad to worse even look like? Whom exactly is it worse for? The leader, their followers, both? Others? Chapter 4 is centered on the four phases of development. Bad leaders and bad followers are not born fully formed. What do they look like at the outset? Most start by being good in some obvious ways, or at least not bad in every obvious way. As indicated, what happens after that is that they change. Some change from being more obviously good than bad to being more obviously bad than good. Others change from being a bit bad some of the time to being a lot bad most of the time. Finally, in the final phase of the four-phase process, they all go from being obviously bad to being obviously worse. But what's that about? If it's correct to say that bad leaders get worse over time if left unchecked, why don't we followers check them? Why do we give leaders license, implicitly or explicitly, to behave badly and then to behave worse? Part two of the book seeks to answer questions such as these. It consists of four chapters, or four stories, or four cases, about four leaders and their followers. Two of these leaders are in the political realm, two in the corporate one. One is German, one Turkish, one American, and one Chinese. Three are men, one is a woman. Three are in capitalist countries, one is in a communist country. They are diverse, but the diversity is not statistically significant. Here are the criteria on which the four leaders were selected. 1. Each had to be contemporary. 2. Each had to have been in a top leadership post for at least 5 years. 3. Each had to have a record of leadership that was well documented. 4. Each had to have been clearly consequential. 5. Each had to have been in some obvious way bad. And 6. Each had to have had followers who, similarly, were visibly bad. Part 3 of the book digs deeper into each of the four phases of development. Each chapter is about a different phase, from bad leadership and followership as embryonic, to bad leadership and followership as full-grown and full-blown, from leadership and followership that are at least slightly benign, to leadership and followership that are clearly malignant and often toxic. The book concludes with the epilogue to bookend the prologue. The prologue is an introduction that pertains to the present. The epilogue is an exhortation that focuses on the future. It gets to the heart of the matter. Can knowing that bad leadership is a process prompt us to stop it, maybe even reverse it? Can we, in other words, change our ways to inhibit or even halt an otherwise inexorable progression? Knowledge is power. In this case, our power can and should spring from the knowledge that bad leadership and followership are not static. They develop over time. They go from bad to worse. But they go from bad to worse only if we allow it. If, in contrast, bad leaders and followers are checked before they corrupt, at least before they corrupt completely, the outcome can be different. Part 1. Looking In. 1. Democracy in Decline and Capitalism in Question. Rarely in the history of American democracy has there been such uncertainty about its viability. The same applies to American capitalism. It, too, is under scrutiny, as it has not been since at least the Great Depression almost 100 years ago. There is, of course, a connection between the two. Failures of capitalism create uncertainties in democracies, and deficiencies in democracies raise concerns over capitalism. In the United States, democracy and capitalism have been in tandem since the beginning of the Republic. In fact, the ideology undergirding both is essentially the same, the one a reflection of and companion to the other. Democracy celebrates the rights of individuals, including the right to be relatively free and unfettered politically. Capitalism celebrates the rights of individuals, including the right to be relatively free and unfettered economically. America's political creed embodies and embraces ideals such as freedom, equality, and independence. America's economic creed embodies and embraces ideals such as liberty and individuality, essentially the right of any single individual to reap what he or she has sown and then keep it. Not for nothing was Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman's classic book, since 1962 it has sold over 500,000 copies, titled Capitalism and Freedom. Not for nothing did he extol the virtues of both and their interdependence. It is impossible to have capitalism without freedom, Friedman argued. Similarly, it is impossible to have freedom without capitalism. Economic and political freedom were, he claimed, irrevocably entwined, each one dependent on and sustained by the other. Over the years, some of Friedman's ideas have been discredited, or at least questioned. Moreover, the practices that he preached have been modified not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world as well. It is now widely agreed that to have a maximum of political freedom, some constraints on economic freedom are necessary, such as the levying of taxes. One could even argue that in the United States, the related debate is central to the political divide. How much government intervention should there be not only to stabilize the economy, but to equalize it. The relatively hard right, including libertarians, say none or nearly none. The relatively hard left, including progressives, argue the opposite, that significant government intervention is not only desirable but necessary to bring a semblance of equality and equity to American democracy. They further argue that without greater equality and equity, democracy will crack and, in time, break. Americans at the top of the economic ladder generally refuse, at least publicly, to admit to the connection between capitalism and democracy, though some of the rich, especially the ultra-rich, are known for their philanthropy. There is no evidence that most, or maybe even any, have an interest in seriously changing the system that made them a fortune. This notwithstanding the fact that since the 1970s, inequality in the United States has become significantly more extreme. Even the pandemic exacerbated the disparities. Thanks to stock market gains, stimulus, and a pandemic recession that largely bypassed white-collar jobs, Americans were able to save an estimated $2.5 trillion more than usual since the pandemic began. But these savings were accrued nearly entirely by those who already were relatively wealthy. In mid-2021, those who were not, the bottom 20% of households, accounted for only a small fraction of overall spending, most of which was on basics such as food and housing. By 2023, the phenomenon was global. The world's rich had never been richer. In fact, according to a global wealth report by Credit Suisse, the wealthiest 1% owned about 50% of the money in the world, while the poorest 50% owned about 1%. To claim that an imbalance as extreme as this one can possibly be healthy for democracy is to whistle in the wind, which raises questions about how this happened. How did democracy decline? How did capitalism come into question? Though there is no single answer, leaders, elites, people in positions of authority, are the most visible of the various explanations. More than anything or anyone else, they and their followers have an impact even when they are passive as opposed to active, are responsible for where we are and for why we are where we are. This particularly applies to leaders in government and in business. In the United States, certainly, it is they who perpetuate the political system. In the United States, certainly, it is they who perpetuate the economic system. Moreover, wittingly or unwittingly, they collude. America's government leaders work hand in glove with America's corporate leaders to sustain the status quo. Such change as does come about, invariably, is a consequence of pressure from below, from ordinary people, followers, who, for one reason or another, or for more reasons than one, are sick and tired of the status quo. Democracy in decline. Since the presidency of Donald Trump, the level of anxiety over the resilience of American democracy has reached a new high. Not since the Civil War, or perhaps the Great Depression, has democracy in the United States seemed so precarious. Not because of a threat from without, but because of a threat from within. The United States is so riven by division, including about what is truth and what is falsehood, that hope for America as a durable democracy in which reasonably honest and competent government is a given has flickered. There have been murmurings of civil war, and there was for a time certainly a significant increase in crime and gun violence, especially while Americans grappled with an unfolding pandemic, deep political divisions and social unrest, economic disruption, and social isolation. Some of the high anxiety was as personal as it was political, a particular response to President Donald Trump. But Trumpism and everything that it implied outlived Trump in the Oval Office, not only at home but abroad as well. Many of the doubts and much of the despair that came to be associated with the apparent decline of democracy are global, which is to say that liberal democracies around the world have been affected by dysfunction and afflicted by decline. Years before Trump was even elected, political sociologists...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?